All right, so welcome, everyone. Welcome to Tech Ed. Welcome to the last day of Tech Ed. It's nice to see, you know, well, since we're recording, it's nice to see that we have a full house, right? So today we're going to talk about SharePoint on Windows Azure. No, hell did not freeze over. This is a really exciting time to be able to finally run our SharePoint workload in Windows Azure, right? And so we're going to talk about that today. We're going to show you a bunch of things that you may have not seen already, recap some of the things that you've seen in a different context, in the context of SharePoint, and I think you'll find it interesting. So my name is Paul Stubbs. I'm an architect on the Windows Azure Center of Excellence in Microsoft Services. So my previous background is in SharePoint. My current background is in Azure. So when the topic came up, they asked me to take a look at this, and we've been doing this for, you know, 6 months or so now. Been running this scenario. I have a couple of customers here today that I've been working with and that have been excellent. And you've seen one of them already in the Aflac keynote that Mark Rasinovich did on Monday, to show that full farm and show the commitment that Aflac has to this model and how they're moving their business forward. And I also have another customer with me here today, PwC, PricewaterhouseCooper, and we're going to see how they're moving their tax operations management systems into SharePoint and Azure to give you some real context and real applications that people are actually doing this today, and they're moving their environments out there as we speak. So the big news, again, if everybody knows these people, these are SharePoint royalty. You probably see them every day if you're a SharePoint developer. You've come to know and love them. Now you can run them on Azure. So you can go out into the cloud and see them every day as well, and you know, tell them your deepest secrets. And but again, you know, SharePoint on Azure is probably the common question I've gotten for the last 3 or 4 years. Does SharePoint run on Windows Azure? And the answer was, well, kind of. It runs in the cloud. But we could never say that it runs on Windows Azure, because it didn't. And so now we have that opportunity, we have that ability to run our SharePoint workloads in Windows Azure, and take advantage of all the features of Windows Azure, which really is the exciting announcement for this week. So we're going to talk a little bit about why you would want to do this. Why should you care if you're a SharePoint developer or you're a SharePoint organization? We're going to talk about some of the ways that you can do it and some of the things that you should think about when you decide to move to Windows Azure. And then I'm going to show you a couple of examples. I'm going to show you how to stand up in a developer environment. I'm going to show you how to stand up a full SharePoint farm, and we're going to show you how to automate all of that using PowerShell. Sound good? Is there anything missing that someone wishes that we discuss? And we have a couple of secret nuggets in here, too, that we'll talk about. So when and why would I use SharePoint in the cloud? Well, there are a number of reasons, and all of the reasons are the same reasons that you would, in general, move any application to the cloud. There's really nothing specific about any of these reasons on this list, other than these are the fundamental benefits of a cloud computing model. And you get those same benefits for your SharePoint environment as you do any Azure or any cloud-based application, right? We have the ability to move more quickly. You know, in the case of PwC that I'm going to show you, you know, they have the ability to bring their application, which is a SharePoint application, to a customer and then deploy it for that customer, even if the customer says, well, I really don't want you touching my internal SharePoint department. Can you put that someplace else for me? They can just roll in and slam down a copy of their app for this customer. Right? Gives them the ability and the agility to make these scenarios happen. You know, focus. You want to stand up a new SharePoint environment. How long does it take today to do that? A long time, because you have to get, you know, requisitions, and you have to buy new hardware, and you have to go through that process. That takes your focus off the core, which was, I had a business problem that I was trying to solve with SharePoint. Let me just go solve that business problem and move on. And then the economics, right? Like the time and the expense to having that environment up and running, and to have, you know, a SharePoint environment at peak. Maybe you only need it for a short period of time. Do you buy the hardware for the peak capacity to handle that short period or that short window? And then what do you do with the hardware afterwards? Right? It doesn't scale very, very well on premise. So these are all standard reasons that you would do it today. Now, we think about this as the SharePoint continuum here. And the reason is that today, if I want full control, I want to be able to twiddle every bit and see every nook and cranny of everything in everywhere, I can run SharePoint in my own data center, on my own machines. That's what we do today, right? If I'm willing to go the other direction, where I give up a little bit of control, but I gain much more efficiency by just going out there and saying, I need a new Windows, a new SharePoint account, I need a new Exchange account, and I need a new Link account, and just go out there and create accounts for users. In this case, SharePoint Online, Office 365, I don't have to worry about anything. I don't worry about the hardware. I don't worry about the software. I don't worry about patching. I don't worry about any of that stuff. I can just do that. But the downside is I give up a little bit of control. I can only run sandbox solutions. I can't run certain features of BCS. I can't, you know, install full trust solutions, right, on and on. So there, that's some of the trade-off. Well, now what we have is we have sort of a middle ground solution, which is I can run SharePoint hosted in a Windows Azure virtual machine and gain back most of the control that I had before and gain a lot of the efficiency that I could get from an Office 365 implementation. So it's kind of the middle ground, right? So what kind of things should I run on my SharePoint workload? Well, we think about running standard Fizz sites, right? SharePoint for internet sites. This is, you know, I've got a standalone marketing site that I just throw up there. It's anonymous access. It's, you know, content management. It's things like that, right? Standard what you use Fizz for today. Good candidate. Also, another good candidate is developer testing and staging environments. How many of you have developers that want to develop on SharePoint but don't have the hardware or don't know how to set up the SharePoint environment for them to develop on, right? Now, in this environment, I can just throw these devs up into an Azure VM role and let them do their development there. Because, as you know, the limitation is that you have to be on the machine that you're developing on, right, with SharePoint. We could also use it for staging environments, you know. What if I want to deploy an instance of the SharePoint environment for testing or staging? Where do I do that today? Do I have to buy double the amount of hardware on-premise to do that? Or maybe I'm running an on-premise application and I just use Windows Azure in the cloud to do my stage and test. And then as soon as I'm done with the stage or test run, I just tear it all down and I only pay for, you know, that day or so when I was doing the test. Then I can install it back wherever I have SharePoint running today, right? So it doesn't have to be just the production site. Hybrid applications, I think, is probably going to be the key. This is where I'm going to move some of my stuff out into the cloud, but I still have a lot of stuff on-premise that I need to deal with, so it's not an all-or-nothing thing. I'm not moving everything to the cloud. Now, I think in the keynote, there was a good example of this with the Aflac demo. It may have not have came out very good in the presentation of it, but in that application, if you remember, there was a click-to-call application. And as they went through the click-to-call, the last step was like, when am I going to call you back? When is Aflac going to call me back? Well, the way they determined that was they made a hybrid. They made a message call, a service call, to their back-end system that did all the calculations on the work on the load of their call center and then returned the results to their front-end system. Classic hybrid example. Right? Their call center remains on-premise, but they need to call services that help them calculate when call times are going to be free or when they can call customers back. But hybrid doesn't only mean on-premise. Hybrid is getting to be more and more IaaS cloud to PaaS cloud, or IaaS cloud to SaaS cloud, or SaaS cloud to an IaaS cloud. So, for example, you could stand up Office 365, use BCS to talk to a SQL Server instance running in your IaaS role. Or you could stand up an instance of SharePoint on a VM role and have it talking to SQL Azure, right? Or have it talking to Office 365. So hybrid doesn't only mean on-premise. Hybrid also means cloud to cloud and different sectors of the cloud. And then another area which is interesting is around disaster recovery. We see a lot of customers interested in doing disaster recovery, but the problem is in order to do disaster recovery, you basically need a mirror of your environment up and running, which is basically double your cost, sitting around either in a warm or hot standby mode, ready to go. What if you could do that same thing in the cloud, where you have your hot standby or your warm standby environment in the cloud, and then if a disaster occurs, using something like Traffic Manager can automatically switch to the cloud version of your SharePoint site. It's kind of the best of both worlds, you know. Maybe you're not quite ready to do a full to run your, you know, your .com out there on Azure or your internet site on Azure, but in a disaster mode it works, and so you feel comfortable doing that because the cost savings are so great. Right? So again, hybrid solutions, when we think about this, think about how, for example, on SharePoint and IaaS role, can talk to an on-premise service using the new SharePoint virtual networking or VPN solution, talking back to your Cisco or Juniper router on-premise with a secure IPsec tunnel. You can also talk to Office 365 using things like BCS or calling that directly. You could even get back on-premise not only through the VPN tunnel, but also through other things like service bus relay, topics and subscriptions can allow you to create services in a PaaS role that can surface up either tables for BCS. So in other words, I could connect Office 365 through Windows Azure service to tables, blobs, and SQL data, right? Or I could use BCS to create an Azure service that actually talks to some on-premise database through Service Bus Relay. So the thing is, think about SharePoint and think about these cloud applications not as islands, but as connected sort of states that go together and work together to form a single application. So let's talk about some migration approaches. So some of the things that you need to think about are dependencies. So when you move or when you plan to move your SharePoint farm out into the cloud, what are the dependencies? Are there any dependencies that are there that you have to think about? For example, one of the things we see about with software requirements is people moving from SharePoint 2007 or 2003 directly to 2010 through the cloud. So instead of buying and upgrading all that hardware, they'll move directly to the cloud with that application. Licensing is a big one. Do you have third-party controls, widgets, and gadgets in your SharePoint farm that are not licensed to be run in a cloud environment? Something you have to look through. Are there other hardware requirements that you have? Are you using some sort of RBS provider that writes to the file system and they expect things to be a certain way? Do they expect multiple network cards, right? There are limitations in the way the cloud is built today, and you have to think about those as you move your application. So some of the things that we can do, forklift migration, just pick up your VHDs that you have on-premise today. So in this scenario, imagine you're running SharePoint virtualized today in either Hyper-V or VMware or wherever. You can just move those VHDs to Windows Azure and start up your farm that way. We call that kind of forklift migration, lift and shift. The other thing you could do is start thinking about, are there parts of my SharePoint site that could move to a PaaS model more easily? Are there things in my SharePoint site that may make more sense running in a PaaS model to start making the application hybrid? And then the last thing is, are there parts of our application that have to stay on-premise? And how do we split those out and move, you know, if 20% of the application has to stay on-premise, does that mean all of it does? No, we can work to move 80% and achieve savings from that way. So we already talked about the first one here, about just migrating existing VMs. The second one's also interesting, which is build your VM in the cloud. So instead of uploading a giant VHD file or a number of giant VHD files, maybe a better approach would be that you build the SharePoint farm on the fly in Windows Azure using something like PowerShell. And that's the approach that we took, and that's the approach that I'm going to show you how to do today. So how do I migrate a simple VHD to the cloud? If we think about what we have today, the way that a developer will run a VHD is normally they'll download that VHD file already done or build their own. In this case, there's already an existing SharePoint developer image out there. How many people use this image? The information worker VHD? How many people have no idea what I'm talking about? So in, switch over here. What's that? Yeah, so it's a Hyper-V VHD image. So let me open up my browser here. So one of the things that you do, if you just come out here and search for SharePoint So the SharePoint Information Worker VHD, first hit, you get a link to my blog. But in my blog, I have a link to the actual location on Microsoft servers. And so here you can come and download this VHD. And the beautiful part about this VHD is that it's a single VHD with everything already set up and configured. It has SharePoint on it. It actually comes in three separate VHDs, but it has SharePoint on it. It has Fast Search. It has Visual Studio installed. It has Office installed. It has all the services turned on. It has Visio. It has Project. It has Link. It has Exchange Server. So everything in the Office world is already built and installed on these VHDs for you. So as a developer, all you have to do is just download the VHD, upload it into Windows Azure, and start using it. And so that's the case we have here. So we can just simply take this VHD, download the Information Worker VHD, unzip it. Then we use a tool, CS Upload, to upload that VHD into Blob Storage. Once that's uploaded into Blob Storage, we can then create a VM mapped to that VHD. So that is brain dead simple way for a developer to get started today with developing on SharePoint without any hardware requirements, without having to understand how to install everything, which takes a number of days if you do it by hand.
So your SQL's on one of the VMs?
So the SQL server is on the first VM, which has SharePoint. So the first VM that has SharePoint, the 2010A image, has SharePoint, SQL Server, Visual Studio, Office, AD, and DNS installed running on that machine. Yeah. It's not a best practice. It's a developer practice. So,
does it expire?
So the question is, does it expire? The answer is sort of. It's an image that has been, it's a trial image, so it's all trial software, and it's been reset to 180 days. So you can use it for, as soon as you start it up, that's when the timer starts again, and you can use it for 180 days until you reset it again for another 180 days. So it does expire, so if you're doing development work for more than 180 days, it will expire. You can reset it and do it again. And so that's what you want to do. You could build your own image if you want to with the PowerShell scripts, and things will show you. I also have another script called Easy Setup Script, which is a PowerShell script that shows you how to install and provision SharePoint. You could go search for that today and download that if you want to build your own images.
What about the cost of all that storage in Azure?
So the cost of storage in Azure. So storage in Azure is relatively cheap. But you do pay for the cost of having those VHDs. So one tip, if you're building VHDs, so when you do CS Upload does a couple of things. First thing, it converts your dynamic disk to a fixed disk. And so if you're creating a VHD with SharePoint on it, and you do, you know, create empty VHD, what happens? How big is your disk going to be? Anybody know? Anybody besides the Microsoft guy know? So by default, when you create VHDs in Windows or just using command lines, the default disk size is a dynamic disk at 127 gigabytes. But when you install stuff, you only use 20 or 30 gigabytes, and that's what you see. But when it gets converted to a fixed disk, when you upload to Azure, it's going to be expanded to the 131, 127 gigabytes image. So what you want to do is you want to make sure you shrink those or create a VHD that's at the right fixed disk size before you upload to Azure. But even if you don't do that, the costs aren't that. I mean, it's really cheap. I mean, 9 cents. What's the cost? 9 cents.
Sorry, what's the comment I want to make about it?
Yeah. Right, that's a good point. So the comment was that they only charge you for the actual bits of the file size you're using. Yeah, there's a cost calculator on the SharePoint site we can look at the end if you want to go through, and we can calculate that cost for you exactly. The last thing we need to do is that now that we've created this VHD and we've mapped a VM to it, we can optionally create endpoints for this VM. Here, in this case, we're creating two endpoints, port 80 and port 443. But as a developer machine, we may or may not want to do this, because typically what we'll do is we'll just RDP into that environment when we get there. So let's take a look at what that looks like here. Switch back over. All right, so what we have here is if we look at our environment, let's look at this one here. So in this account here, what I have is I have a number of virtual machines running, and the first one up here is my developer machine. So if I come down here and I actually click on this, it'll generate an RDP file for me that I can open. And when I open that RDP file, this is the machine that I RDP into. This is the 2010-10A image. And if I look at it by opening the browser, we can see that it has our friends on the homepage. They're already installed here, ready to go. And it has a contoso.com domain, and this is the intranet site of contoso.com. So this is already built for us. We don't have to worry about this. We can also see things like Visual Studio is installed already on this machine. So if we want to run Visual Studio and actually start doing some development, everything that we need as a developer to build SharePoint 2010 applications are already here for us. So all I need to do is come over here, fire a new project, and here are all my application types ready to go. Just by simply copying and uploading this VHD file into Windows Azure, I'm, as a SharePoint developer, immediately productive and ready to get started. And then you can see, you know, all of the other things that are installed on this thing, Fast, Link, Office, and so on and so forth. So it's a great way to get started, a great way to kick the tires. So how did we do this? So one of the things here is that the problem is that you have to download this VHD. It's actually rather large, and then you have to unzip this VHD, which takes a long time because it's really large, and then you have to CS upload this thing to the cloud, which takes a little bit of time because it's very large, right? Is it a question? Can you wire this Visual Studio up to TFS Preview? Yeah, I don't see any reason why not. It's just I think it's ultimate version of Visual Studio 2010 SP1, I believe. So you should be able to. Yeah. So with all that said, one of the techniques that I've done here is I actually, in my cloud storage account here, I actually just create a small server as a server that I can leave up in the cloud to do all of that copy, unzipping, and then uploading into Azure, because it's already in the cloud. So I don't have to copy it down to my desktop and then back up into the cloud. I just use this server as the way to copy. And so if we RDP into this server, basically what I have is I have the ability to download all of that, all of the files that were part of that information worker set that I downloaded. Then I just simply unzip it and then use the CS upload tool. Use the CS upload tool here. Use the CS upload tool to actually upload the image. And so in the tool here, what we've done is you can see that the first thing I do is I call set connection. And then I pass in my subscription information and my certificate. Now, one of the things you have to do in order to get the certificate down is you have to actually go out into Azure and you can generate the thumbprint locally and install the certificate. But one of the ways that I like to do it is I like to actually just create my own certificate manually. That way, as I go to many machines, I have the exact same dev certificate that I use from machine to machine, and can simply just install the certificate on this machine that matches the thumbprint of the certificate that's already installed in Windows Azure, which is what this one is. So if I look at this thumbprint of this certificate, and we look at this one, let's see here, we see that the 1460 is the same thumbprint, 1460, as the certificate that I'm going to be using. So the certificate's installed locally. It's installed in Windows Azure, and then I can use the thumbprint to do it, point to the management endpoint, and all I need to do is actually call add persistent VM image to upload this as an image. Right? And then the CS upload will take care of the rest. It'll do all the copying for me. It'll put it in the right location, and it'll change it to a fixed disk and so on. So that's it. That's as simple as it takes to copy the images up into Windows Azure. And then once you have them up there, it becomes very easy to then TS into them and use them and go on and so forth. Questions on that? Yeah.
So about how big is the collection?
So the question is, how big is a collection of the images? So I have a lot of images running here. If I look at my storage for these, you can see that here are some of the file sizes of the ones I have out there running. So in my storage account, I have a lot of VHDs running. There is actually a tool in PowerShell that you can run, and what it'll do is by setting a couple of parameters, it'll look down through all your VHDs that aren't attached to anything to then give you the opportunity to delete them, because maybe you have orphaned or maybe you've copied some or whatever, you want to do cleanup. So you can use PowerShell to help you clean up and get rid of ones that aren't being used and things like that, so that makes it easier. But in general, using a tool, something like Cloud Explorer, is a good way to get started to help you understand how big everything is. Okay, so that was interesting. You know, great, developers can do things in Azure, but I want to run a real SharePoint farm. I have real work to do. I can't play around, you know, playing on the computer all day writing code. I got real things to do as an IT pro, right? So when you think about a SharePoint farm, if you're not really familiar with SharePoint, SharePoint can be divided into a number of tiers. And as a best practice, we have things like a web tier, which the web tier handles web traffic and caches the web page for you. And you can scale out the web tier to as many servers as you need. Then we have things called the application tier. The application tier runs things like central admin website. It also handles all the services, such as the Excel services or the index server or the search service or Word services, right? All the services that are in Excel or in SharePoint run on this server. Now, kind of the beautiful part about SharePoint is that any machine can act as any role, and the only difference technically between different machines is which services you turn on or turn off. So if I turn off basically all the services, it's a web front end. If I turn on only the index server, it's an index server. If I turn on only the Excel service, it's an Excel server, right? And so you can scale out tiers individually in your group based upon the workload that you're doing. So if I'm doing a lot of Excel service calculation, I could have 10 boxes that do nothing but Excel services. If I'm doing a lot of indexing of content, I could have 20 boxes that do nothing but index content, right? And so you can break that out and do that in any way you want to. Traditionally, the pattern is that you turn off all the services and you have web front ends that handle basically the caching of pages and the general basic page stuff. But that doesn't mean that you can't mix and match that and do whatever you want to. And then in the back end, all the content is by default stored in a SQL Server database. So you will have a database storing all that content. But in reality, this is what your farm will really look like once you get it built out. This is, you know, I have 4 web front ends, I have 2 app servers, because everything, every tier and everything along the way, you want to have full redundancy and full fault tolerance. So not only for scalability, but for availability. So we have 4 web front ends, we have 2 app servers serving up central admin, we have 2 SQL Server machines mirrored with a third one as a witness. We have 2 Active Directory servers and DNS servers, load balanced and fault tolerant. And in this case, we also have a VPN tunnel, the virtual private networking tunnel, back to our on-prem system to do things like, you know, make service calls to the mainframe or backend, or to maybe in this case the AD is a read-only AD controller in the cloud, and we're connecting to sync our AD. So in general, this is the type of farm that you build. This is the structure that you saw for the Aflac demo, and this is the structure that you'll probably end up building when you build. Now, the thing that's important about this is that the first thing we have to do is we have to create a cloud service to hold our Active Directory machines, our DNS servers. And so we create those in a separate cloud service. Then the next thing we do is we create one or more cloud services to hold our SharePoint farm. In this case, in this example, there's one. And we put all the SharePoint stuff in that one cloud service. So remember, the things within a cloud service can talk to each other. And cloud services can talk amongst themselves if they're wrapped up or put on the same virtual network. So in this case, we take our 2 cloud services and we wrap them with a virtual network, and then we expose that virtual network through the VPN to our on-premise systems. Does that make sense? The next thing we need to do is we need to have some way for people to access our SharePoint farm. In order to do that, we need to open up a load-balanced endpoint. And so we create an endpoint that points port 80 and port 443 to our web front ends. And we'll see in the example that I show you later too, we could also point them to our app servers, because an app server Again, every role, every SharePoint machine can serve basically any role. But generally, we don't do that. But if you wanted to, it's possible. And an example we'll show you a little bit later, we did that because we wanted to save space. You know, we have limited cores in our test account, so we use the NAP server and a web front end load balance across both of those to save some space. But in a full environment like you saw at the keynote, this is what we were running. Then what I've also done here is I've actually load balanced central admin servers. So central admin is actually running on both of the app servers. And we opened up an endpoint on port 2012 to those app servers so that administrators can come in and administer the SharePoint farm as well in a load balanced, in a fault tolerant way. So even if one of those servers goes down, they can still get in and do things. Questions? Is this what you expect? Good? All right, so let's take a look at how this works. So the first thing I want to show you is an actual application that we've deployed to our SharePoint site here, to our farm. And this application is an actual production application. This is the tax operations manager of PwC. Companies use this today to manage their taxes and to do all of the complicated corporate tax stuff that goes on. And this is a real full SharePoint site running in Windows Azure. We can see things that if we go down into like our tax process and click on that, we get a dashboard that your tax people use this dashboard to manage their taxes. And millions of dollars go through this kind of application to do these really high-end corporate taxes, like at Microsoft, for example. You know? Here we can click into our application and see we have things like performance pre-track transaction planning, review and analysis of the LOI. We can actually drill into these items and mark them as red or, you know, take other action on the items. And then we come back and we see that the information is you know, not bold, showing that we've done that task. But all of this information is all backed by real SharePoint data. This isn't some, you know, application that's not contained within the app. If we look through our site settings here and go to view all site content, we can see that the application has all of the information. So it has document libraries for you to upload your tax documents. It has lists and settings. So the application is totally configuration driven. So you just go in there as a tax user to change your configuration around and set up the taxes the way you want to do it. You can see information about the calendar, cycles. There's content types in here that drive the entire tax process. And this type of application, in the past, is a little bit challenging to install because companies have SharePoint set up a certain way in their company, and it's difficult for them to allow vendors and companies to come in and install other SharePoint apps. And so as this way, building this in Windows Azure, companies can even come in and just pop an instance of Windows Azure and give that company access to their information. So this is a really great example that we've been working with PwC on to show how to do this. And I just want to thank Josh Kuhn here, who's in the front, who's the director of the Tax Operations Manager. So if you have any questions about the application itself, him and his team are really doing a great job of building these kind of advanced systems on Windows Azure, and you can talk to him about his experiences. But the real question is, how do we build this kind of application? So if we close this, come back over to our portal site here. So we can see, if we come to our portal site, we can see that we have a couple of accounts running here. So I'm running my account, and then we have the PwC account running here. And this is a good example of where you might want to have multiple accounts split up so that you have your staging people using one account and your production people using a different account. and that you move and migrate applications from staging to production through separate accounts, right? Maybe they're different billing. Maybe you want to have that extra layer of isolation between the accounts. So the first thing to look at on this site is the load balancers. Here you can see we have our web front end, we have our app server, and we have our SQL Server machine. So if we click into the actual web front end, we can look at our endpoints, and we can see that we have a number of endpoints set up. We have one for web, port 80. We have one for the RDP port, so you can actually RDP into these machines. And we have one set up for SSL traffic. But what you can see is that this port on port 80 goes to the private port on port 80, and it says that it's load balanced. So if we actually click into this and edit this endpoint, we can see that it's load balanced across the web front end and the app server. So in this case, again, I would just to save space and to demonstrate load balancing in a constrained environment, we can leverage any role in SharePoint to do this. And so in this case, we're leveraging both. But in your environment, you probably have just this load balance across your web front ends. Now, the advantage of this is that traffic gets load balanced across the various sites. So if we come back to our page here, one of the kind of tricks that I've done here is that if you go into, let's see if I have this open. So if you drill into the web front end, so this is the web front end server, and if I come down to the SharePoint site and edit the V4 master, so each web front end in SharePoint caches the web pages, in this case the master page, on each web front end. So I wouldn't recommend doing this at home, right? Don't run with scissors and never touch the master page using the command line. But it's an interesting technique if you want to show how load balancing works. So what I've done at the very top of the master page, I've added a comment to the master page specifying the machine that this master page is running on. And I did that also for the app server. So what happens now is that when I come to this web page and I hit F12, we can see in our source code the server that this page was loaded from, right? This is a good way to know, is my load balancer working for real? And if I come here and I refresh the page, we're still on app one. So now we switched and we just got load balanced to the other server. And so we can see how you go back and forth to verify, because there are some times you can set up endpoints. So one of the things when you set up a load balancer or set up the endpoints is you can specify a custom probe path. And sometimes if you don't have that custom probe path correct or it doesn't exist, the server will say, the load balancer will think that the server's not online. And so you may not know that you're not round robining to that server, if that's a word. Right? And so this is a good technique that's unobtrusive to the users, but easy for your support people to understand what's going on. So as we refresh, we're on app one, then we're on the web front end, and so on and so forth, and we keep load balancing back and forth across those servers, right? The next thing that we want to look at is, well, how did we set up the virtual network? So if we come back to this machine, what we see here is that I have a virtual network set up. And in this virtual network, I have two subnets, the domain controller subnet and the SharePoint subnet, right? Based upon that diagram that we were looking at earlier. So I have two subnets set up to hold those cloud services that I belong to. So we can jump back out real quick here and look at our cloud services. Here's the domain controller cloud service, and here's the SharePoint cloud service. And each one of those has their own subnet, which is specified here in our virtual networking configuration. What's that?
Why did you split those out into services?
So the question is, why do I split them out? So one of the things in Windows Azure is that there are no static IPs. So if I have a domain server, a DNS server, I don't have a static IP for that domain server. So one of the things we can do is we can stand up a domain server first in a cloud service. Then we know, because you don't have static IPs, but you have infinite dynamic IPs, right? And so what we can do is we can stand up that DNS server in its own cloud service once. Then when we create the SharePoint farm, we know the IP that we can point the SharePoint farm to for DNS. So anyway, so here we have our virtual network. We can see our subnets. So my subnet range is from 10.100, and my two subnets are 10.1.1 and 10.1.2 as my subnet range. I don't have any DNS servers configured, and I'm not connected locally to the thing. If I switch over to the other account that I have going, if we look at this one is a little bit fuller. This has four web front ends. If we look at the load balancer for these endpoints, we'll see that we have all four of those web front ends load balanced across the set. But more interestingly, what we'll see is in this configuration, we're connected through a VPN. Well, not now because someone turned my desk off in my office, but we're connected through a VPN tunnel, through a Cisco ASA 5505 router to a machine on premise. And we can see information about how much traffic's going in and out, what the IP address of the gateway is, and we can see, in this case, you know, information about we can see information about our gateway, and we can see our subscription, and we can see the affinity group, and so on. So that's what it would look like if you actually have a VPN router connected to that information. It'll be there. It'll show up in your virtual networking. So virtual networking is for standalone VNets in the cloud or connecting a virtual network through a VPN connection as well. And then the last thing that I want to show you here as kind of a bonus before we move on and drill into some more detail about how this was built is that one of the things that I have here in this virtual network is that we have this machine right here. So one of the things we did was we said, well, we're going to stand up this giant SharePoint farm in Windows Azure. How do we monitor that? How do we manage that? Well, the way that you manage and monitor servers is through System Center. So what we did, we said, well, can we stand up a System Center machine in the cloud, in our cloud service, along with the rest of our SharePoint farm to help monitor the cloud from the cloud? And so what we've done here is we've actually stood up that machine. And we can see from here that we're monitoring a number of items. And in this System Center, we have a lot of management packs installed. We're monitoring SQL Azure. We're monitoring SQL Server. We're monitoring the clients and the servers. We're monitoring SharePoint. We're monitoring applications, Azure applications in the cloud, right? Other cloud services, all through a single pane of glass, all using System Center here. And so it's interesting as... if you've never seen this before, if we drill down into our SharePoint product, we can see a lot of information about SharePoint. Now, this isn't set up 100% correct, and one of the things that comes when you have a System Center management pack is you get a lot of best practices built into the management pack, kind of like tech ed in a box, if you will, the TechNet stuff in a box, right? And so that's what we're seeing some of these alerts on the side saying, well, you know, it's probably not best practice to use the administrator account for every SharePoint account, right? And you get some things like that in these alerts. And you can follow them or say, well, you know, I know better, and so on and so forth. But you get a lot of great information there. Another cool piece is we get this diagram view. And so in the diagram view, it's kind of cool because we get basically we get kind of a visual of how our SharePoint farm is behaving, right? And so we can look at the SharePoint farm and we can do things like we can drill down into the information. And then you can see here it's showing us all our web front ends. And then we can drill down into a particular web front end. And we can see all of the services running on that web front end. So in this case, the web front end has only a couple of services running. If we look at for something like the app service, we can see that the app service has a lot more services turned on. It has central admin running on that service. So you can look at inherently all of the kind of features of SharePoint from your System Center box that's running out there in the cloud with your SharePoint farm. So it really gives you a lot of great information about how to do that. We can see things like events and other performance information. So from here we can see, we can see how each page and each server is running and what it's doing and gather information about there. So there's lots of information as a SharePoint administrator or as a system administrator that you can really pull out of SharePoint. So here, for example, we can monitor, the information of our SQL Server machines. We can take a look at those, see how much space we have. We can see our performance data. We can see the server roles. So there's lots of really great information that we can pull out. And so not only for SharePoint, but for SQL Server, for SQL Azure, for cloud services, for the servers themselves, it just gives you a whole wealth of information that you can draw upon. So cool. So you're thinking to yourself, well, that's a lot of stuff to install. Well, luckily there's PowerShell. And if you haven't seen or if you don't love PowerShell today, seriously take a look at it. It's life-changing. Is that too dramatic? There have been a couple of really great sessions this week, so go back and watch the videos for them. They're really great on how to get started. But what I want to show you is just some of the basics of what we did to get started with PowerShell in SharePoint. So if you go to this link, and I'm going to show you how to get to that link in a second as well, so you don't have to memorize it. But the way that Windows Azure Management works is that there's a REST API that sits on top of Windows Azure. And it allows you to manage all of the things in Windows Azure, storage and VM and services and networking and everything that you see the portal doing, there's an API behind that. And in fact, the new portal is actually built on those web APIs. There's no other kind of secret stuff going on that the portal can do that you couldn't do. So theoretically, you could write your own portal using those same APIs if you want to. Now, what the PowerShell guys have done is they have taken and wrapped all of those REST APIs in PowerShell. So you basically have PowerShell equivalents and PowerShell semantics on top of all the management API stuff in Windows Azure. And that's what we're using. So can everybody see this? All right, we're going to walk through this so it's not as bad as it seems at first. And there's a lot of piping going on. One of the cool things that PowerShell guys like to do to flex their muscle is pipe lots of commands together in this illegible kind of stew of coding nirvana. But when you break it down, it's really not that bad. So the first thing that we're going to do is we want to create a new configuration for our virtual machine? What's the name of the virtual machine? Which availability set should it go into? Which image name should I use? How big should it be? Right? These are the things that you would check in the dialogue that you would go through and choose. So you do the exact same thing in PowerShell. And then there's the pipe command at the end, which means take whatever came from this and send it to the next line. So the next one is that we want to get our provisioning configuration. So one of the cool things about the way that Windows Azure provisions machines is that there's this kind of unattended XML file, if you're familiar with that concept, that has information about what the machine should do when it comes out of a sysprep state and goes from a generalized to a specialized state. That's what you're specifying here in this line. You're basically specifying the parameters that you would find in your unattended XML file. So we can specify the domain name we should use, what's our username, what's the domain password, what OU should I be attached to, and which domain should I join. So we specify those things. And again, those are the same things that you get asked in the dialogue as you go down through. The next thing is, what endpoint do you want me to expose? So that you can create the VM and create the endpoint at the same time. So in this case, I'm going to create an endpoint on port 80, and I'm going to also create a load balance set with a specific name, which is something you can't do in the portal today. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to specify a specific probe path that will check the health check slash iasstart.htm page, or whatever page you want to. And the beauty of this is that it not only pings the server to see if it's alive, it calls this page. And that page, if it returns 200, the load balancer will assume that that server is alive and will send traffic to it. But the beauty of that is that in that page, it could be anything. It could be an ASPX page, it could be an HTML page. But you decide, you write the code in that ASPX page to determine if it returns a 200 or not. You could then go and look at other settings. You could go look at the database. You could look at processor load. You could look at memory. You could look at disk space. Whatever it means for your application to be ready to take traffic, you do that in this probe path. The page that the probe path calls, you write the logic to determine what you want it to do. In this case, I have an empty page, which the empty page always gets returned as 200 if the server's alive, so that's all it does. But you, in a more sophisticated scenario, should look at other characteristics of your environment to determine, I'm alive, but stop sending me traffic. I'm a little busy right now, right? So those type of scenarios you can do by specifying a load path. And then finally, in this case, we specify a DNS name, and then we actually create the VMs in one line. Now, that one line above, so everything above the red line is one PowerShell line, technically. So everything above the PowerShell line, you would do over and over again for every VM you want to create, and then you can build them all in one shot on the end here, because you can see there's a comma delimited list of VMs, and that VM name, $, which is a variable in PowerShell, SPWFE1, matches the configuration that we created at the top. So all we're doing is creating a number of definitions, and then we're actually creating concrete instances from those definitions in this bottom line. Does anybody's head hurt yet? Yours?
Can I ask a question on the endpoint and load balancing?
Yeah.
Does
the load balancer support authenticated requests? I believe the answer is no. So you have to have an anonymous endpoint for the load balancer to probe. All right. Ready to look at some real code? Other than PowerPoint code? Yes? Okay. So we're almost in the home stretch now. Don't nod off, you're going to miss the best part. Okay, so let me show you this real quick just on how to get started. If you come out to Windows Azure, let's close this, come to develop, choose the language of choice, .NET. Then here is where you install the SDK. And the reason I mention this is the SDK is a prereq for the PowerShell command, so I want to make sure you understand how to install this. So here we have two choices, old school or new school. And in fact, these actually run side by side, and I'm actually running them side by side on my laptop, and it works really slick. So if you have both or one of these installed, choose the one you have and install that SDK with that. And that'll come with the 1.7 June SDK, and it'll have the Azure tools, it'll have the compute environment, it'll have everything you need to do Azure development in this SDK. The next part is you need to install the PowerShell commands. So if you're a developer, where do you go from here to install the PowerShell commands? Hopefully enough negative feedback will get the web guys to change this. Where any guesses? Who knows like what the next thing to click on to go? Where would you guess to go next? You gotta say something, or people on the video will think the room's empty. Okay, I'll give you a hint. I want to use PowerShell to manage SharePoint, to manage Azure. So I click on the Manage tab. Now where do you go? Other. It's like other. So tutorials. Yeah, not there, right? Hard. It's actually in downloads, and it's right here to install the PowerShell commands. So I show you this because it's not intuitive, but once you see it once, it's not horrible. But it's not intuitive to get there on your own. But then download and install the PowerShell commands on top of the SDK, and then you'll have everything that you need to do. Now, one of the things I recommend highly if you're not a PowerShell guru is to use download and install PowerGUI. It's a free PowerShell editor. It allows you to step through, set breakpoints, just like you were in Visual Studio. You can change the code on the fly. You can F10 stepping over your code. It's awesome, right? As a PowerShell developer. It gives you really great-looking, color-coded PowerShell, and so on and so forth. After you install the PowerShell commands, make sure you actually go and follow this help link. Let me bring this up for you. So you should really follow this link because it's very important to get started. The first and most important thing is that you need to install the PowerShell commands by running the MSI. Then you actually have to come here and run this import module. This is what kind of imports all the modules, to PowerShells, into your environment and allows you to run this. But this command, so it says step two, type the following at the Windows PowerShell command prompt. But, you know, I'm a pretty smart guy. I'm using PowerGUI because I'm cool, right? This does not work in PowerGUI. There's a weird bug in the system. So don't download PowerGUI and then run this. Follow the instruction. Open the normal Windows PowerShell command prompt and run this. That'll set up your environment. Then once you do that, you'll have everything that you need to get started with PowerGUI. And in this case, now I can see if I do, you know, get Azure, I can see now I have all of the commands from the Windows Azure PowerShell in my environment. And if you get IntelliSense, you know you've got it set up correctly and you're ready to go. And then we can do things like, you know, if we want to get started, we can do get our subscriptions. So I can see all of the subscriptions that I have installed. So if I come down here and run this, I can see that I have a bunch of subscriptions installed. And these subscriptions come from, if you go back and follow the help doc here, once you do this here by doing download your publish profile. That will import that subscription, including your thumbprint and your certificate, from your Azure account on your machine and register it in PowerShell so that'll show up in the list. So if you have a subscription called Dave, Dave's going to show up on your list after you import using this command. So follow this first doc, otherwise it's going to be a long day. Then once you have that, here you can see I've created a couple of PowerShell scripts to build the farm. In this case, I just specify the subscription I want to use. Then what I need to do is I need to specify the location. Well, how do I determine what the location is? I can actually call get Azure location. And then I only want to see the name, so I'm just going to say, hey, just show me the names. So I pipe it to a select name. So if I run that command here, it shows me, hopefully. It shows me all of the locations that I could install my affinity group and set up my accounts and so on and so forth. So these are the same ones that you would get to pick from if you were doing this in the portal. So once I have one of these, like EastUS, I can plug this in. Then I can also specify the description and my affinity group. Remember, the affinity group is kind of, I want to tell Azure everything in this affinity group, keep this as close together as possible in the data center because they're used together as one thing, and I want the performance to be as best as possible. So I create an affinity group for this. Then what I want to do is I want to create a Azure virtual network. But first I want to clear out any old ones in case I rerun the script multiple times. Then what I need to do is I have to specify the path to an XML file, which is this is my virtual network configuration file. And you can get this by building it by hand, or if you come into your virtual network, you can download and it will export your XML file for you, okay, as one approach. The XML file will then be used here. When I do my, I set the virtual network. So this builds my virtual network. And the virtual network definition is not really that complicated. Here's the whole XML file. And really all it's saying is I'm going to create some virtual networks. I'm going to create one called SPVNet. And it's going to have this address range and these two subnets that, these two subnets that you saw earlier, right? So I just specify those. If I'm doing a VPN, it's a little bit more complicated. I just have another section for local network, which specifies my VPN location. Other than that, that's about as complicated as it gets. This is the XML file I pass. Now what I can do is I can actually go and get that to verify that which XML file I have loaded. So if I run this here, we can see that all that did was basically returned the current XML configuration for the VNet that's in there today back. And so I could use this as a starting point. So I could go in into the portal and create one by hand and then export it to kind of see what it built is another way to do it. So once we build this, then I need to create my cloud service with my domain controllers. And this is, in essence, the code you just looked at. So in this case, what I do is I get my subscription, which is what we saw before. Now I need to pick the VM because what I want to do is I want to create an image using an image that's in the library. So how do I know what those image names are? I can just call get Azure VM and see what those image names are. And this will return me all of the image names. Cut and paste isn't working here. Weird. Paste this in here. And this will return me all of the images and their technical name that I need to pass to create a new one, right? They have a nice noun name that you pick in the portal, but the technical name is what you're seeing here and using for this. So once we do that, all we do is specify that same information you saw earlier, the subnet I want to use, the password I want to use, what size the disk is, and I'm creating two of these. In this case, one's commented out, but I can create two of these by doing what we said. So I specify the configuration information of the first one. I specify the configuration of the second one. And in fact, something new in here is I'm actually also going to attach a data disk to that, because when you create a domain controller in Windows Azure, it's recommended that you store the DNS information, the AD information, on the data disk. So we create a data disk and attach it at the same time we're building the image. So we do that. Here, this would be the second one. And then all we do is just say new Azure VM, passing in the configuration of those VMs. That creates our DNS. Then the next step is a manual step, or we could automate it, but it's not automated here. You then go to that new VM, run DC promo, do whatever you need to do to that virtual machine and DNS to get it all set up right. Then once that's up and running, you come back to this next step, which is actually to create the farm. And creating the farm is exactly the same thing we did before. I specify the images I want to use. I specify the networks. I specify the names. I specify the administrator names. And then I create them. There's number one, two, three. I can just go create all those web front ends. I create all the app servers. And then I just come down here at the final end and build them all out. And at that point, then I would just go to each one of those machines, run spconfig and install SharePoint, and away we go. And we have a full SharePoint farm up and running. So your call to action is think about scenarios where you're running SharePoint today that may be opportunities to move that in the cloud. Maybe they're not used very heavily. Maybe they have spiky usage. Maybe you just want to kind of get rid of them out of your environment. Maybe you're trying to upgrade. Think about those scenarios and then look to see how you can get your feet wet in going with this. Start using it to build develop machines. Very easy. Download the VHD, upload it. You've got a full developer environment up and running. Run PowerShell, learn PowerShell. Understand how to use that to build your SharePoint farms and start building small farms, whether it's just one or two machines. It's a great way to get started. Finally, we have some related content for you to go back and look earlier. There's other information about using Office 365, using SharePoint and stuff online together, so take a look at those. Some other resources for you, Hands on Labs, make sure you guys are doing all of that. You've probably seen this stuff a million times. Other resources for you. Please fill out your eval. I think if you give all fives, you get a free Xbox or something on my eval. Anyway, thank you very much, and I'll be around if you want to come up and ask questions, and I look forward to talking to you.